John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And here are the questions on the floor of the Senate and for everyone in America today. What did America know about terrorism and how did it learn it? What did the CIA do to terror suspects and why did the Congress know about it in time? And what do we know now and why has it taken so long for the people of the U.S. to learn it if we ever get to see the truth about CIA torture tactics at all? Senator Dianne Feinstein said on the Senate floor today that she means to get the country there.
It's been very difficult, but I believe the documentation and the findings inclusions will make clear how this program was morally, legally, and administratively misguided, and that this nation should never again engage in these tactics.
Following a long political fight, Feinstein's Senate Select Committee on Intelligence released an executive summary on the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation techniques, that famous phrase we've come to know as a euphemism for torture. We also learned about the practice of extraordinary rendition, capture of suspects, and transporting them to a third country for interrogation. Techniques and tactics all implemented during the George W. Bush administration, an era that apparently began with these remarks by Vice President Dick Cheney in a conversation with the late newsman Tim Russert on Meet the Press back in September of 2001.
It is a mean, nasty, dangerous, dirty business out there, and we have to operate in that arena. I'm convinced we can do it. We can do it successfully, but we need to make certain that we have not tied the hands, if you will, of our intelligence communities in terms of accomplishing their mission.
These terrorists play by a whole set of different rules. It's going to force us, in your words, to get mean, dirty, and nasty in order to take them on.
Right.
That's Vice President Dick Cheney speaking on September 16th, 2001. Today's Senate report is basically an attempt to close the chapter that began with 9/11. Continued with the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, the opening of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, and everything that flowed from the emotional, tragic, terrified reaction to the events of September 11th, 2001. Is this report old news? Are there new revelations? Does the long saga of Congress's battles with the CIA and the White House to release this report tell the story of an Obama administration reversing on transparency in the war on terror? This hour, we'll talk at length about the report, what it tells us about our practices of interrogation and torture in the war on terror, and whether Americans ultimately have a right to know about covert operations. To start us off, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So this is a really important moment for Dianne Feinstein. Today is the culmination of years of work.
There's no question about it. The genesis of this report, of course, goes all the way back to late 2001 after the attacks of September 11th. The Senate Intelligence Committee started getting involved with this issue directly in 2007, a couple of years after they heard that CIA officials had burned videotapes of enhanced interrogation. Once Senator Feinstein and her Democratic colleagues, in fact, some of her Republican colleagues on the Intelligence Committee found out about that, they launched a full-scale investigation. This report was launched officially in 2009 and was complete more than 2 years ago, John, and it's been over the last 2 years an extensive amount of wrangling, fighting, and negotiation, not only with the CIA, but also with the White House, and a president that said they supported, fully supported the compilation and release of this report in an unclassified form, but all the while negotiating, wrangling, trying to hold back Senator Feinstein in many ways from releasing a full report. And she finally gets it out today, I should add, just a couple of weeks before she is no longer chairman of that committee. Republicans, of course, taking over the Intelligence Committee when they take over the Senate in early January.
Right. Well, there, you know, regardless of the arguments with the White House, there's no holding back on certain individuals named in the report. Dianne Feinstein particularly talks about former CIA Director Michael Hayden.
The description in the cables of CIA's interrogations and the treatment of detainees presented a starkly different picture from Director Hayden's testimony before the committee. They describe brutal around-the-clock interrogations, especially of Abu Zubaydah, in which multiple coercive techniques were used in combination and with substantial repetition.
What you heard there in that clip was not an edit. It was actually just a sort of an electronic glitch that took place as the senator was speaking on the Senate floor. Is she accusing Michael Hayden of lying to the committee?
She's accused Michael Hayden of lying to the committee before. It's not the first time. She also got an apology over the summer out of CIA Director John Brennan when he had to apologize to the committee and to the Senate after Feinstein accused CIA lawyers and tech people and officials of spying on Senate officials and Senate staffers on their computers when they were compiling this very report. So it's Hayden, it's Brennan, other CIA officials by name as well. The brutal treatment that Feinstein was just talking about of Abu Zubaydah and other people. Senator Feinstein detailed on the Senate floor how from August 4th to August 21st of 2002, consistently, and for that entire 2.5 week period, Abu Zubaydah was subjected to abuse in Afghanistan at the hands of the CIA. The report details, John, a CIA facility called Cobalt, which people there called a salt pit, where detainees were kept in isolated cells, shackled to the walls, according to the report, had loud music blasted at them with only a bucket for human waste beside them, kept in the dark, abused physically, punched and slapped on their way down a hallway to interrogation. Those are just some of the new brutal details detailed in the report.
And she, you know, takes personal sort of shame from this. She says the United States cannot do these kinds of tactics and should never do it again. Does this report ensure that that will be the case, or does it simply underscore something that will probably go on?
Well, that, I mean, how can we predict the future about that? What we can say is that President Obama, when he took over as president in 2009, explicitly outlawed torture by name and some of the techniques that are included by executive order, and Congress has passed some legislation since these programs were discontinued. Feinstein says her hope is to prevent the CIA or other intelligence officials or anyone in the United States from ever returning to similar tactics, no matter what the security conditions dictate. She said that on the Senate floor today, that she insists that the United States never return to them. Now, can we predict the future about whether or not that ever would happen? No, of course not. But it's her aim to prevent that ever from taking place again.
And I saw a tweet from John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, or someone quoting John Kerry saying this should not characterize, this report should not characterize the nature of the U.S. intelligence record. But for the time being, it certainly is going to characterize what the CIA did during the Bush administration. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
The release of this report tells secrets and outlines some controversies that other nations around the world might have preferred to leave under wraps, whether it's more fuel for longstanding enemies of the U.S. or allies who carried out some of the covert operations at the behest of the Bush White House. This is a troubling day. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, says that it could get hot back home for some allied leaders.
There are two foreign government issues out here, John. One of them is that there were some foreign governments that hosted black sites where some of this interrogation took place, and they'll have a hard time explaining why they cooperated in the way that they did. This has been a big issue, for example, in Poland. Now, Poland is not a place where you would expect that there would be a Benghazi-like problem. But you could imagine in the Middle East how this could be used for propaganda purposes by ISIS and others, especially at a time that we are accusing ISIS of truly brutal methods.
As a longtime observer of all of this, what do you think is the more serious charge? What the CIA did, according to this report, or that the CIA acted as a kind of rogue agency all on its own, according to this report?
What the CIA did, I think we've known in its broad stroke. To my mind, the question of whether the CIA acted beyond its mandate, even from the Bush administration, even loose as that mandate may have been, is in many ways the more important issue, because it gets to the question of whether all these decades of improving civilian oversight of the CIA are actually working.
And, you know, at the end of the day, thinking back to the Oliver North case, and he certainly thought he had permission to do what he was doing and was prosecuted for it, there's always going to be somebody at the CIA who believes that they have permission to do something questionable, because that seems to be the culture that's been created. And the Obama administration isn't necessarily going to be able to change that. An assessment from you?
No, I think that's right. And if you go back to the memoirs that were written by some of the people who were involved in these operations, they are all pretty explicit that they believed that they had some cover for their activity. So it's very possible that they thought that they were given a broad mandate. And secondly, you have to remember, this the CIA is an institution that you want to have taking risks. If you don't take risks, you don't do the bin Laden operation, right? Highly, highly risky operation, could have easily gone bad, and in the end it was a success, and as a result, it is considered among one of the great successes of the agency. But that requires a risk-taking culture, and I think that one of the concerns that the CIA director, John Brennan, who's very close to President Obama, has is that the seeming punishment of those, even those who may have acted beyond the law, would over the long term so change the culture of the CIA that it would become too cautious.
You know, without enhancing your career in any sense, I was going through my office today and I opened your book, Confront and Conceal, that you wrote about the Obama White House. And I'm just wondering, in the choice of words, do you think at the end of the day, the Obama administration has confronted the CIA, or have they chosen to really stick with the concealment?
There's been a mix of the two. I think that early on, there was a fair bit of sense of confrontation. And then the president began to back away some. You know, if you look at what the Obama administration has done to water down some specific elements of this report, just the battle over redactions, it would tell you that they've been closer on this issue to where the Senate Republicans have been than they really have been to where President Obama was early in his campaign.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
We leave the Earth now. NASA's Curiosity rover may have discovered new evidence of the possibility of pre-existing life on Mars. The Mars rover has been hard at work exploring a 96-mile depression that formed more than 3.5 billion years ago when a meteor slammed into the planet. And now the mobile laboratory has detected that the crater might have once held a lake and that the aquatic sediment from that lake has transformed over time into an 18,000-foot mountain shaped by winds and rising from the floor of Gale Crater. Joining me now to explain is Tariq Malik, managing editor of space.com. Tariq, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So, possibility of pre-existing life. Let's do the forensics here. Basically, the Mars rover has detected conditions that are consistent with life, not actual, like, you know, shellfish from some lake, right?
Exactly. So what they've found is the hint, evidence that Mars was habitable at one point in time. This new discovery suggests that it was stretched out not over a few million years, but tens and tens of millions of years, where life could have flourished in a wet, warm environment on Mars. And it's something they've never seen the evidence like it before.
And does this come from looking at the sediment or looking generally at the sort of, you know, wide angle view of this Gale Crater?
It's really from Curiosity's observations of this central mountain itself. It's called Mount Sharp, and it rises 3 miles up off the floor of this crater. And what they had hoped to see when they got there were just different kind of sediment layers all the way up that would tell the story of this crater over, you know, the 3 billion years or so that it's been around. That's what they're seeing now. They've got these layering rocks that they've never seen before that says exactly as you mentioned earlier, over time it was filled with water. That water might have ebbed and flowed, but if you can imagine a 100-mile crater or a hole filled with water, I mean, that's just a massive amount of water to be on the surface of Mars and be sustained by the environment that allows it, because today there is no liquid water on the surface itself. So it says that it was a different place for a long amount of time.
How good of a view does the mobile laboratory have of this layering effect? Because you say layering effect, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, like tree rings, does this tell a story through time that might indicate layer by layer of different conditions over those millions of years?
That's exactly what the scientists are saying. We heard from John Grotzinger, the main scientist on the mission yesterday, who had basically said that they can see a layer where it was really wet, and then there's a layer where it's dry, where maybe the water kind of either evaporated or dried out, or on top of that, another wet layer where it was covered in water again. And that's what they're looking at to see the evolution of this lake in the crater, you know, how full it got, when it might have dried out to allow the winds to sculpt a 3-mile mountain at its core, and then where that water went. You know, the fact that they had this lake that could be sustained by the atmosphere, so the atmosphere was wet and warm to allow that amount of water, is just perplexing to them right now.
Now, has any scientist used the F word and actually said, you know, fossils, the presence of actual fossils? I mean, they must be freaking out.
You know, not yet. You know, they're really taking things slow. And in fact, the scientists made a really big point that this is kind of their theory with what they're seeing now. They haven't published the research in a journal yet. They're still collecting a lot of data. Curiosity has only been on Mars for 2 years and only at the base of this crater for, you know, the last few months or so. So they've got a big job ahead of them because they want to actually climb this mountain with the rover to get, you know, even deeper into that story. Curiosity does have microscope cameras. It has really high resolution instruments. It can, you know, shoot these layers with a laser to see what they're made of. If something's there, there's a good bit that this rover would find it.
Now, scientifically, it's also possible that there's a explanation for this and that these conditions could exist independent of any life ever being discovered, right?
Well, there's always the possibility that it's a geological story.
Right.
They do know that this region, this crater, has all of the signs of running water on the surface. They found a riverbed dried up about a year ago, and now they're seeing this evidence of a really kind of insurmountable evidence of a lake. So water, you know, on Earth is, you know, one of the cornerstones of life. And that is kind of the going theory for scientists when they explore Mars. If they find the water, there's the chances that there could be life there. And that's kind of like the holy grail, if you will. It doesn't say that there was life actually there right now or in the past, but if all the conditions are right, you would expect that something could happen.
Holy grails, smoking guns. We've been hearing this for a long time. Where did the water go?
Well, and that's one of the big questions. So Curiosity is on the ground looking at the kind of the situation of the geology. What is the evidence of you know, the water in the rocks? Maybe the water is underground. There's a lot of evidence that there's huge caches of buried ice water underneath the surface that you could maybe even mine if you had astronauts on the surface. NASA actually just has a new spacecraft that arrived this year called MAVEN that is in orbit around Mars and is looking at the problem from the sky to see where did the water in the atmosphere of Mars go. They think that maybe the sun's just the solar particles, you know, might have blown it off over time. But that those two missions hopefully will really tell the tale and, you know, in good time.
Was that beep some communication from Mars there in your office, Tarek?
It might be. I'm going to have to go check. I apologize.
All right. What's the chemical composition of Mars as Curiosity understands it before we go?
Well, basically, we know that Mars is, you know, right now dry and dusty. What they are looking at now are these minerals called hematites, and they're seeing a lot of it.
Tarek Malik is managing editor of space.com. Thanks so much. What's your reaction to the disclosure by the Senate of the report on torture by the National Security Establishment of the U.S.?
Tony from Miami, Florida. I actually feel that there are certain things that Americans do not have the right to know about and that the intelligence community should be given their privacy. It is by nature a clandestine process and it should be kept that way.
Pam, I'm calling from Richardson, Texas. I believe we have a right to know, but the safety of our country and our citizens has to take a priority over a right to know. I prefer the right, or at least the hope, for a nation free of terrorist attacks and to know that our government is doing everything possible to prevent such actions. It's irresponsible to release information knowing it puts us at increased risk.
Or Caldwell, New Jersey says, come on, national security concerns are nonsense. Nothing was ever gotten from these people who were tortured. Everyone who is tortured just creates more terrorists. Keep the debate going. Join us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Over the weekend, when U.S. Special Forces were said to be about 100 yards away from U.S. photojournalist and Al-Qaeda hostage Luke Summers, another hostage, South African Pierre Corky, was reportedly mere hours and $200,000 in ransom money away from his freedom. A few moments later, both were dead when the element of surprise was lost and Al-Qaeda insurgents shot both hostages, Summers and Corky. South African charity Gift of the Givers had been working for months to free Corky after successfully freeing Corky's wife last January. With me now from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Imtiaz Suleiman, the director and founder of Gift of the Givers. Welcome, Imtiaz.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mr. Corky was a teacher over there. Why did you get involved in attempting to negotiate his release?
Mr. Corky was a South African. I am South African. We have an office in Yemen. We've been there since 2012. And it was in June 2013 when my office manager, who is a Yemeni, saw in the media that a South African couple has been captured. He called me, said, "Do you know them?" I said, "I don't know these people, but they're South African, and if we can do something, let's get involved and try to see what we can do. The least we can do is try. Maybe we'll succeed, maybe we won't."
How frustrated were you by the circumstances and how they turned out?
Look, it was heartbreaking. We understand the circumstances, but it was heartbreaking, especially since it took 11 months. You know, we worked on this from the 10th of January right up till the 6th of December. In the process, some of the tribal leaders got killed by drones. My office manager had to leave the country because he himself was threatened by Al-Qaeda. He was accused of stealing ransom money that the South African government was supposed to have brought and given him to give to them. Of course, this never happened. This was not true. Here, his wife was ill. She had cardiac problems. We had to pull her out of the country. It was insecure. And at the last moment, after so many months of going up and down, with fighting, with drones, with difficult terrain, we finally got the permission on the 26th of November. We were less than 24 hours away. That morning at 5:59 a.m., I told Yolande Corky, who is the wife of Pierre Corky, the waiting is almost over. To have a message like that full of hope and suddenly 2 hours later to get a call to say your husband is dead, it was totally devastating.
Based on this experience, do you think it's appropriate for the United States or for anyone to pay fees in compensation for the death of individuals in Yemen from U.S. drone attacks?
I think that is only fair. By accident, when these things happen, it should be some degree of fair compensation according to the living standards of those people. It reduces hatred. It reduces antagonism. If you go forward and have dialogue and say, "Sorry, we made a mistake. We want to compensate," I think it'll be a very good gesture on the part of the people that have made the mistake.
What's the feeling in Johannesburg and South Africa in the wake of all of this?
A lot of people are very, very angry. You know, they say America has got a gung-ho attitude and just moves in and attacks people. That's the one feeling. The other feeling is, I mean, it's a lot of emotional sensitivity now. We need to understand that 55 million people were behind Pierre Corky. Because he was South African, everybody was behind him in the circumstances and behind his wife. So understandably, people were very angry, especially since he was going to be released and being eaten within 24 hours. But at the same time, there are other opinions that, you know, the Americans had their interest. This was their civilian. They had to do something to free him. Otherwise, he would have been killed. So there is some degree of understanding on that aspect also.
Imtiaz Suleiman is director and founder of Gift of the Givers, the South African charity that negotiated the, according to them, release 24 hours away of Pierre Corky, the South African who was held along with Luke Summers in Yemen, but both died after U.S. forces moved in and their element of surprise was compromised. Imtiaz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure, John. Thank you.
Lost in some of the details of the release of that executive summary on U.S. torture practices is the notion of actual prosecutions. Did people like former CIA Director Michael Hayden commit crimes, and will they be held accountable in court? Will those torture practices be understood as criminal acts from here on out? The Obama administration has apparently made the decision not to prosecute Bush administration officials, but our next guest says there's still a way to identify CIA tactics as crimes. Pardon officials identified in the Senate report. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, says that formally pardoning at least recognizes crimes without putting people behind bars, and it draws a legal line in the sand. Anthony Romero, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, John.
So who would you recommend pardoning and for what at this point?
Well, let's first start with the most important question. What do we do now with this report? Where do we go from here? And it seems to me that unless we take up this question of accountability for torture, we're really not doing the report its service. We need to either prosecute these individuals, and if the president doesn't show the willingness or the appetite to prosecute them, then he ought to formally pardon them. But this limbo we're in of this tacit pardon that crimes occurred but no one is a criminal is just simply untenable in the face of the Feinstein report, which is damning about the extent to which crimes were indeed committed by criminals who are still out and loose.
Well, let's take the case of CIA Director Michael Hayden as an example here, just as a hypothetical. Could the president pardon him for perjury? And in that case, could he appeal the pardon?
You know, part of the reason why I want to throw out this idea of these preemptive pardons is that, you know, once you pardon them, you've labeled them a criminal and you've pardoned them for the crimes. So what Hayden thinks after being pardoned doesn't really matter very much. He's been emblazoned with the scarlet letter C for criminal, for having lied to Congress, for having misled the intelligence committees, for having authorized the torture that happened under his watch. And whether he likes it or not, he's a criminal who's been pardoned. And that's part of the reason why we want to force this question. It is not tenable right now for the Obama administration to mumble this this line saying that crimes occurred, torture happened, but oops, no one's responsible for that, and no one's held accountable for it. That's just not tenable. You don't allow crimes to happen and not hold the criminals accountable. So either you formally pardon them, or you prosecute them. That's the choice.
As a legal matter, though, if you just pardon Michael Hayden for perjury or for these tactics specifically, is the lack of due process, at least in theory there, does that come directly from the universal, the extraordinary powers that the president has to pardon?
Exactly.
There's almost no restriction on it.
There's almost no restriction on it. I mean, the president can pardon anyone he wishes. You can do the preemptive pardons. You could do the en masse pardons like Jimmy Carter did with the draft dodgers. Abraham Lincoln pardoned the Confederate soldiers who fought in the war. Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, as we all know, for all crimes he may have committed in his office. The question here is, what do we do to hold these government officials accountable? And a report that talks about the fact that torture happened, that the CIA misled the Congress, that the public was misled, that the brutal nature, I mean, when you listen to the Feinstein report like I was doing before, and you hear her talk in pretty shrill tones about the gruesome and extensive nature of these torture programs, we have to ask ourselves a question. If we're a nation of laws, and if our nation is one that believes in rule of law, then what are we going to do about these crimes? You can't but just believe that they just happened and that was just a sad moment in American history. People broke the law. So what are we going to do about it? Either we prosecute them or we pardon them for those crimes.
Well,
and the president can't sit on the fence.
Let's take your Nixon example. If we are going to do something about it and set into the record that this can't be done and that to do it would be a crime going forward, we're going to have to do something more specific than what Ford did to Nixon, because some of the abuses of Nixon continued after that pardon. They're going to have to sit down and specifically say, not simply, you're pardoned, Mr. So-and-so, but you're pardoned for this, this, and this.
Oh, yeah. You'll have to lay it out. And I think part of – look, there's no easy or perfect solution to this. But right now, it's just untenable. We have Tenet, we have Bush, we have Cheney saying these weren't crimes. We stand behind what happened, that the Senate Intelligence Committee has got it wrong. That is an untenable situation. Because in 20 years, when you have another, when you have the George Bush's grandson in office, who believes he can resurrect the enhanced interrogation techniques and torture an individual that's in their custody, unless you put a very clear end to this torture story, it will always come back like a vampire from the dead. You've got to stab it through the heart and say torture is illegal, it is unlawful. If you commit or authorize torture, you will be held accountable because we do see it as a crime. And I think part of what we're frustrated with is that for over 10 years, we've been talking about the importance of prosecuting. I remember sitting in the back row of the Alberto Gonzalez confirmation hearing thinking, we've got to call for prosecutions. And for 10 years, we've been hitting that drum. And the president has has completely dodged the issue. Crimes happened, but no one's held accountable. Well, now we're trying to force him off the fence. Pick a side. Prosecute him. And jump on this side of the fence, or pardon them and jump off on that side of the fence. But don't sit on the fence and say that torture happened and there's nothing we can do to ensure accountability. That's just untenable. The idea that we can sweep it under the rug, that we can say it's an unfortunate moment in American history and not do anything about those who perpetrated the crimes, it really does our nation a disservice. And there were men and women in the armed services and in the CIA who refused to engage in the torture. Those are the true patriots. And by letting off the criminals who authorized and perpetrated the torture and treating them as if they did their job in the line of duty as we wanted them to, does a disservice for those great men and women who are actually trying to uphold the law and ensure the nation's security. And that's where I say that this limbo that we're in and the defense that the president has sat on for the last six, seven years is just untenable. Jump off, one side or the other. Prosecute or pardon.
Anthony Romero is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union on what might be a legal lesson and legacy of the U.S. reaction to the terror attacks of 2001. Anthony Romero, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate it.
This country doesn't torture. We're not going to torture. We will interrogate people we pick up off the battlefield to determine whether or not they've got information that'll be helpful to protect the country.
I do not agree with the use of the word torture.
The only defense against terrorism is offense.
We also have to work the sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly without any discussion.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong.
Most of us didn't know what waterboarding was when we began this.
Everybody needs to know what happened and why it happened.
It appeared we turned a blind eye in many cases.
We tortured some folks.
The president believes that on principle, it's important to release that report.
We practice torture and do things that diminish and even harm the image of the United States and motivate our enemies, then it could have profound consequences in the future.
We did some things that were contrary to our values.
This nation should never again engage in these tactics.
One chapter closes, another one opens. America's secrets, disclosed mistakes, and public attempts to redeem the missteps in the war on terror. Be a part of this conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE, facebook.com/thetakeaway, or at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.